Welcome to Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. Hello, Chicago, and welcome to another elucidated episode of Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. Well, on today's podcast, we have a very special interview, so you are going to have to pay attention, because this is going to be a good one. Also, Tom Williams brings you another audio review. And of course, as always, Chicago's theater news. So sit back, relax, and get ready to talk some theater. Hello, Chicago, and welcome to another episode of Talk Theater in Chicago's news podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of August 21st, 2006. Teatro Vista has announced their 2006-2007 season. Teatro Vista, or Theater with a View, is a theater company committed to sharing and celebrating the riches of Latino culture. The season kicks off with the Midwest premiere of Another Part of the House, which will be opening on September 19th at the Chopin Theater. Following that is a co-production with Rivendell Theater Ensemble, and it will be the Midwest premiere of Elliot, A Soldier's Fugue. This production is part of Steppenwolf's Visiting Company Initiative and will be opening in November. The third production is the world premiere of Massacre, Sing to Your Children. That will be coming in April of 07, and this one is by Jose Rivera and will be directed by Chuck Smith. Massacre, Sing to Your Children is presented in association with the Goodman Theater and will be shown on the Owen stage. Head on over to Talk Theater in Chicago's Theater News section to find out more information. And a little bit of national theater news for all of you actors out there. Stella Adler, of the famous Stella Adler Studio of Acting, has finally received a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Posthumously, Stella Adler died back in 1992, but many of her students, ranging from Robert De Niro, Candace Bergen, and Benicio del Toro, were all there for the celebration. Adler began acting at the age of 4 and founded her studio back in 1949. It's just nice to see that Hollywood's finally paying some attention. Well, for all of you wine and Shakespeare lovers out there, there is a benefit that may be right up your alley. First Folio Shakespeare Festival will be presenting the A Cask of Amontillado, a wine tasting benefit, for First Folio Shakespeare Festival's The Madness of Edgar Allan Poe, a love story. The benefit will take place on September 9th from 7 to 10 o'clock. Now, the tickets are $45 in advance and $50 at the door, but if you go, you can actually enjoy a cask of Amontillado. And don't worry, they won't bury you alive. For those of you who have been listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago interview podcast, you may remember an interview with Derek Trumbly and Bill Larkin of the 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee at the Drury Lane Water Tower Place. Well, did you know that one of the stars of the Spelling Bee is also in a movie? That's right, Derek Trumbly recently co-starred in the short DVD called Coop's Night In. You can view the trailer for Coop's Night In at elantrafilms.com. That's elantrafilms.com. Well, thank you very much for listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's news podcast. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So until next time, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it. Thank you.
Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's Review Podcast. Here's my review of Leaving Iowa. Leaving Iowa, a comedy about traveling, by Tim Clue and Spike Manton. It's at the Royal George Theater in Chicago. Leaving Iowa travels the back roads into our hearts. Leaving Iowa, a family vacation comedy, is an example of a work that delivers fine, richly humorous entertainment. Leaving Iowa is a tad too long and repetitious, suggesting some cuts are in order. The opening night audience at the remounted production, now playing at the Royal George Theater, the show originally started out at Theater Building in Chicago. The audience laughed heartily and often, and rightly so, from Tim Clue and Spike Minton's funny script. Leaving Iowa is a worthy nostalgic ode to the good-hearted, patriotic, average American small-town father, bent on getting his daughter and son to enjoy the yearly road trip in their station wagon. The story revolves around a journalist who returns home to Winterset, Iowa, to find a final resting place for his father's ashes. The memory play is the son's attempt to finally realize the depth of his love that he had for his father. Told in flashback, Leaving Iowa is a sentimental comedy that speaks to everyone who has ever had to endure the family car vacation to some vague and uninteresting historical site with a well-meaning but naive father. Bradley Armacost leads the excellent cast through the car scenes where we see Daddy getting lost with the kids moaning, "Are we there yet?" so often that I wanted to take the wheel and get them to their destination. Tim Clue and Spike Minton have sprinkled several fine anecdotes filled with likable small-town personas, giving homage to the Iowa of the 1950s. Dad is the nerdy mensch we've all met and secretly admire, even when he irritates us to death. Brian McCarthy, a large man and the perfect everyman type, offers several outstanding caricatures as rural men roles, while Barb Wingard was terrific as the daughter and the Gabby waitress. Kelly Cooper was excellent as Don, the son of the and narrator. The play has much to like, including several funny vacation adventures that remind one of Mayberry and the Andy Griffin Show. Leaving Iowa grows on you as it meanders its way into your heart. If you stay with the show, the many repetitive car scenes, Leaving Iowa ultimately satisfies as a feel-good comedy. This show has many funny moments. As presented, Leaving Iowa echoes "Are We There Yet?" as a truism. If Leaving Iowa has a 90-minute piece, Dad would say his famous "You betcha" with a confident smile. This is one of those family shows that when you see it, it really does sneak up on you. You like it much more after you've seen it. My recommendation for this show? Recommended. It's in an open run at the Royal George Theater. The running time is 2 hours and 30 minutes with intermission. It is at Royal George Theater, 1641 North Halsted in Chicago. For more information, call 312-988-9000. That's 312-988-9000. This is Tom Williams saying go see a play this week. Thank you. Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's Interview Podcast. Our special guest today, direct from London, is James Walker, who is the playwright and the author of Proving Mr. Jennings, which is opening in at the Actors Workshop here in Chicago. It opened on August 9th and runs till September 3rd, and it is a terrific play. So say hello, James.
Hi.
Tell us how your play got to Chicago. I know there's a story there.
It got here. It was mounted in London, and then it the script sort of did some rounds. And in the course of those rounds, I spoke to a great friend of mine, whose name is George Cedarquist.
Oh, George is a friend. Okay.
George is a great friend of mine.
He's a terrific young director from Steep Theater here in Chicago.
That's right. And he was very interested, and he wanted to hear about it, and he wanted to read it. So I sent him a script, and he had a look at it, and he was very excited about it because he thought that the issues that pertained in the play were very relevant to American society, and he thought that the British context would allow people to somehow engage with it. And so he got in touch with me and said, I'd like to produce it out here. How do you feel about that? And I was very pleased. I was thrilled. So he then got in touch with, I believe, Michael.
Michael Colucci from the Actors Workshop.
And he got in touch with Michael, and Michael was very positive about it. And the next thing I know, that it's all going ahead, and I'm out here.
Great. And this is the first play you've had produced in the U.S.?
It is. The first play that I've had produced officially. When I was a younger man of about 19, I toured a one-man show about the son of Oscar Wilde along the West Coast. We only did about 4 performances, and then that went to Europe and went on the BBC and stuff. But that was my acting days.
That was your acting days. Now you're a writer.
Yeah, absolutely. I used to act and write, and I've given up the acting and just got my writer's hat on.
Well, this play won the King's Cross New Writing Award. Tell us about that.
That's one of the new writing awards in London. There are a few of them, and it was significant because what came with the award was a full professional production. So that was
excellent.
That was how it came to be first produced, and we had some very good actors in London who came and played those roles, and a very fine director. And then off the back of that, the play got some attention at other places, including the National Theatre, which is
okay. So tell us about this wacky, wicked satire that you wrote. Tell us what it's about.
It's about a barrister, a QC. It's probably no surprise my father is a barrister and a QC himself.
That's an attorney to us Americans, right?
Okay. That's right. And a QC is, which has been one of the things that's slightly lost the references in the play, it's called a Queen's Counsel. Ooh, and yeah. A Queen's Counsel is, I don't know if you have the equivalent here, but when a lawyer or an attorney becomes of a certain seniority and a certain quality, they attain a rank called a Queen's Counsel.
I don't know if we have that, but we do if you argue cases to the Supreme Court or to the Court of Appeals. That's a certain status of attorneys.
Right.
It's probably similar, but I don't think we have a title.
Right, we give it a name. It means when you go to court, you have a junior. Anyway, so that was a Queen's
Counsel.
So
it means he's a top lawyer.
He's a top lawyer, and he spent his life working entirely within the rule of law. In fact, the rule of law for Mr. Jennings is everything. That's how he's worked throughout his entire life. And he goes in for a heart transplant operation and wakes up to find that the doctor tells him that they did not find a heart at all, they in fact found a bomb when they opened him up. And the action unfolds from there, and Mr. Jennings finds himself in the center of a furore over his intentions that he is entirely unaware of.
But you kind of set things up before the operation in a really cute, funny, sexy scene with the nurse. Tell us about that. It stands on its own as a very funny bit, which kind of lets you know that this play is funny.
Well, I wanted to. I mean, it's a little bit like Carry On Guantanamo. That was how I wanted to give it. It's kind of the beginning doesn't give away the intentions of the play in some ways, and it's not until the scene where the nurse starts reading a list of, and if you remember the section where she reads a list of sort of medical inquiries,
yes,
and then there are these what people take as utterly ridiculous ones that are thrown in, like does he have any specialist weapons training? Has he ever been involved in genocide? And in fact, those questions are taken from the customs form that we as British people had to fill in.
Oh, is that right? Those are accurate.
Those are real accurate
questions.
That's what I was doing with Jennings.
Like we're going to admit that.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, do you intend to enter this hospital to engage in subversive activities? It is, in the questionnaire, it was always, do you intend to enter the United States to engage in subversive activities? Yes or no. Have you ever been involved in genocide? Yes or no. These were questions that we were quite seriously asked to fulfill. So I put that within that first scene. Yeah, and I wanted it to be a light, bright opening that kind of misleads you so that when the rug gets pulled and the play turns a lot darker in the second scene.
It also gets you laughing and in a way kind of relaxes you, but then you really take the gloves off.
Yeah, the second that was interesting. It was very interesting to see how that works. So the second scene obviously does. The second scene is the revelation of the of the bomb. The third scene becomes very dark, and it was interesting to see how that played to an American audience.
Because what was your impression?
I think it was. It very much depends on how it's done. If the actors in the preview night, they weren't on top of it, but they were last night, and it was great, and people go with it because it is a moment where an audience can actually go, this is distasteful. But when they go with it and they run with it, it's very exciting because it feels edgy and the audience is laughing, but they're not quite sure whether they should be laughing.
Right. That's the way I felt all the way through it, yeah.
And that was the response I wanted. I wanted this play because it is, at its heart, actually a very serious play, but it's approached in an utterly comedic vein. And so I want people to question that laughing response. I think that's when
So they tell him, instead of having a heart, he's got a bomb implanted.
He's had a bomb, and much like Kafka, where Drew draws a lot of influences from, no one has any idea why, or certainly he doesn't have any idea how or why he's had a bomb as a heart. And
you beautifully don't address that.
No, I wanted to leave that entirely. People come out and they go, I mean, how did it get there? I mean, what exactly happened? And there's clues, and you can follow trails, and you can make up your own backstories to why or how, whether it was a conspiracy or whether it was...
Yeah, you sort of hint at it, but you don't resolve it. And I think that's good writing. That's clever.
I thought there was a draft I did when I kind of made it much more overt as to what happened in the backstory, and it was just terrible. It felt like killing the baby rather than just leaving all the doors open and let people come to their own conclusions.
All right, so now now what are they going to do with him? I mean, he's got a bomb in him, and they're worried about him being a terrorist.
Yeah, that's right.
And they accuse him of that.
So suddenly this the bastion of the establishment, and I think that's why it's so important that it is him. It's not someone called Muhammad who, you know, lives with his
right,
family.
This guy is the quintessential British gentleman.
Middle class, absolutely kind of stands for the state, the bastion of what one would call the, you know, absolutely the English gent. And he is suddenly faced with the fact that they are accusing him of being a terrorist. And much more than that, they inform him that not only does he have a bomb there, but it is on a timer and it is going to detonate in 43 minutes. So the whole of the rest of the play then happens real time.
Okay. But there's a clever hint about the time that you put all the way through that has a meaning at the end. But I won't let you give any of that away, but pay attention to the timeline, folks. It really makes the play a lot stronger. All right, so now they bring in this intelligence agent.
That's right, Mr. Smith, Agent Smith, as he calls
with
it.
With a P.
And Agent Smith went to, people asked me about the name. It's actually a Woodhouse reference.
That's right.
Woodhouse. And I wanted to give him a suitably absurd name because all the names, there's in fact the guy who comes later, Colonel Loveday, is an inversion of the name of the head of MI5. His name was something similar, but just swapped around. And I wanted to give Smith a suitably absurd name, and that Woodhouse reference kind of came to me, so I stole it, and it's lovely, and people think it's always mine. And I always say it is. It's great.
Sure, why not?
So it's quintessentially English, although, and Smith represents that kind of committed, I mean, he's sort of fundamentalist in his own way, with a huge lack of knowledge, and he mixes his religions. And he isn't entirely sure about the details of anything, but...
Well, when he's one of those operatives, when he's told what he's to look for, that's it. And it doesn't make any difference what he finds. He's only looking for what he's looking for. And that's a scary thing that a lot of, I know, the British and the American intelligence have been accused of.
Well, absolutely, and he raises this whole issue, which I think is central, and I think is that the problem with the threat of suicide bombing, which is, as our Home Secretary David Blunkett said at the time, this is a couple of years ago, he said this is the era of preemptive action. There's no point waiting until someone detonates themselves and then acting, because you're putting bits of people on trial, and there's no point in doing that.
Yeah, so, you referenced that.
And yes, that is a direct play. Reference in the play to that. So now what you have to do is you have to arrest someone before they commit a crime, and then you have to try and prove that they might have committed it. So you have to now prove not that they did, but that they had intention to, which is a major shift within the criminal law.
It's also, I think, against everything the Americans and the British legal systems are all about. Maybe that's why the one fellow, I don't know, I think he was from Yugoslavia or someplace, that were they chased in the subway and they shot him eight times?
It was a Brazilian.
Brazilian, right? Yeah. I know it wasn't close to being a profile of a terrorist.
And he was, yes, it was Will Mendes, and that's been a big issue in the UK. Because he was, it was also the way it was handled that the police, and much like Smith, they spun it. So we were told that that this guy had actually been followed. He'd leapt over the barriers at the tube. He'd gone down. He'd jumped and jumped at the train the last minute and pushed through people.
Boy, we're not getting too paranoid. I remember not too long ago when the British police didn't carry guns.
Absolutely.
And now you're gunning people down in the subway.
Well, yeah. this is the and to change.
I mean, we've been doing that for years. I don't mean to laugh about it, but I mean we have, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, there's obviously, and what I tried to do with this play, look, there are serious issues there. Then there are people potentially, and how many and to what extent is something which we will never know. And there's a line that Smith references in the play, you know, this whole idea of Britain's actually, and the same with America, with the exception of 9/11, have had periods of unparalleled domestic peace. And yet we all seem to believe we're living in an era in which we are less safe than we ever have been. Historically, that's just not the case.
That's true. We are the safest we've ever been. Yeah.
And so the way that this pervasive atmosphere of fear is being used to change the flavor of our societies and to import more power to the state.
That's the ultimate goal of a lot of the terrorists. I think that's almost the definition of terror. Spread the fear. For every bomb that goes off, you fear, you know, going on the subway every day and for millions of people. But your character, the major, the Colonel Loveday, he's your spokesman for the government, and he's kind of the voice of reason in a kind of a sick way, but where you really raise some neat issues.
Well,
that's what he's dealing with.
He's like, there must be, you know, are so many people who believe. I mean, even the guys who work at Guantanamo, the guys who worked in Belmarsh Prison. They believe and go home telling themselves and their families that they are doing an essential and very important task. And one could look at that either way. You can say absolutely you are or you aren't. And he puts forward the perfectly reasonable proposition that a lot of people, I think, will subscribe to, and maybe more even here in America than in the UK, that the first and primary right of a citizen is to be safe. That is the biggest, that is your biggest sort of priority. What you have to give up in terms of your liberties and your freedom, how much you're prepared for the government to spy on you, watch you, take a part in your life, in order to achieve that security, is what Loveday is all about. And he's there saying, look, if I have to torture you in order to save 100 lives, is that morally wrong? And this is a case that places like Israel have had to deal with. Does a democracy take to itself methods that it has always shunned in order to combat this threat, or in doing so, does it actually compromise the very values for which that democracy stands? And that's the big issue that Loveday, who does put the state side, I think, raises within the play.
Yes, but you do these really strong issues that are, you know, thinking man's issues that are gray, but you do it in a context where it's serious and yet it's humorous. You're able to laugh at it, but you get your point across. And that's a tribute to your structuring of the play and your writing. And I think that's what makes this play so engaging.
Well, thank you. I mean, what I do feel about the play is that it approaches an issue that could and has been approached in a number of very sincere dramas. And somehow the sincerity of knocking it on the head, and we talked a little bit about Guantanamo. The play.
Correct, yeah. The we had a version of it that played here, a very good version. But you're right. It did sort of beat you over the head with you know, the fact that the five are innocent and how tragic it is that when you're innocent, you've been in a prison for 5 years and you don't even know why.
Absolutely. But I mean, it has to be remembered it is a play, and I know it was a form of journalistic play because it was taken from interviews and all the rest of it. Yeah. But yes, it opened and it made its point in the first 10 minutes. And
that's correct.
2 hours later, you were still hearing a version of the same. And I thought that in Guantanamo, and this is something you can level at Proving Mr. Jennings, although I do try and address it, is that there is an issue, which is that not everyone in Guantanamo is innocent. Now, how you balance these things, because it is a balance in all. There's no right, there's no wrong here. It's a balance. And if Proving Mr. Jennings achieves anything, I like people to walk away and say, I had a great laugh. And then to go, well, actually, was it that funny? And why was it done comically? And actually try and look at some of the issues that it addresses and how do we as a society balance it? And
I think when you engage people and you make them care, and what makes things funny is you care one way or another. There's something at stake that makes you laugh. I think using that motif of comedy, I think, works rather well. Because you can only dramatize it so much. And so I think it works. And your main character is interesting.
Jennings is, yeah. I mean, he's sort of the voice. I mean, as the world gets crazier and crazier around him, as he sees it, he remains in the eye of the storm, the voice, sort of the audience's voice, which is kind of, hold on a second, this is all going way too fast, and everything very physically in terms of time goes too fast, in terms of their assumptions goes too fast. And in terms of, I mean, there's a line where Smith says to him, okay, you tell me you're not a terrorist, we'll prove it. And as he says there, he says, well, I'm strapped to a bed. How can I prove it?
Yeah, how do you prove that you aren't something?
And this is where the whole burden of proof has shifted. And
the basis of democracy that you guys started, that taught the world, was innocent till proven guilty.
And that's, in fact, the wording has now changed in certain trials so that it's now, it now reads slightly different.
Does it really?
Yeah, and the idea of, because of course in the face of this necessity to prove that someone might do something, so this idea of potential crime, which is what, you know, Jennings says. He says, do I look like a terrorist to you? And Smith says, a potential terrorist, yes. And he says, potential? You'd have to arrest, how can you arrest someone on the basis of what they might do? You'd have to arrest everybody. And Smith replies, well, 1,000 more agents are being recruited as we speak, which is the truth in the UK. We've just had 1,000 more.
And it's true here, too. Yeah.
So you've got a lot more people out there, supposed, and are they stopping crime or are they stopping these events? We don't know. It's all hushed behind doors. We're told they are. But this idea of potential, you think, how do you prove that somebody might go on to do something? And this is where it becomes dangerous.
Yeah, and you adding the urgency and the sort of mystery to it, because all through the play, you get the feeling that he's going to prevail. You really do. And I'm not going to give away anything at the end, but I will say that there's some plausible surprises, some unique things at the end, because which really adds to the dilemma. I mean, this is a play you walk out feeling entertained and laughing and thinking about it, and you're laughing, but you're kind of shook up at the end of this play. And that's why I spent a lot of time thinking about it last night.
Well, that's great. I mean, if it does that, then I feel I've done my work.
Okay. And how did you like the performances?
I thought it was great. I think that Damien, who plays the central...
It's Damien Arnold, yes.
Plays a central role, who's an English actor. He has a brilliant ability to really live in the moment. Because one of the things that this play does, if you try and do it arch, and if the actors deliver these lines with a knowing wink to the audience that these are funny lines, it absolutely dies. It has to be played straight as an arrow. And Damien has a wonderful ability to do that.
Yes, he does.
And he's led everyone else. And it's much like, I don't know if you saw Edward Albee's The Goat.
Oh, sure.
And there's a similar...
Albee was here at the Goodman Theatre, did a tremendous production of that play. Yes.
Well, I mean, I hugely admire Albee's work. And what, you know, that play has similarities with Jennings in that the central premise is, to all intents and purposes, ridiculous. A man falls in love and has a passionate affair with a goat. But if you don't, you have to play it absolutely seriously. And this is where George and I have had a number of conversations about this. The irony that needs to be there, which is that, and I think in America people are less used to someone telling you dead straight a complete lie. They're not quite used to that. Comedy tends to be slightly more marked up. Whereas in this, people deliver lines that are absurd and ridiculous but have an integral truth. And they just deliver them absolutely straight. And we can, as an audience, make our judgments. So I was pleased
to
see.
Well, that's something I must say that the you British authors are better at than us Americans. And I don't like to admit too many things that we're not the best at. But, yeah, in terms of being able to write absurdist writing like this. And it does come across. And, you know, it will be a compliment. When you read a reviewer where the reviewer says, well, you know, it was kind of dumb. What's the odds of somebody having a bomb in them? And you're just going to have to laugh at how stupid that is. Duh. That's the idea. And but you're right. That everybody around assuming that is reality and playing it straight is what makes it so funny. It makes it work, yeah.
I have to say on that note, it will be. I do feel that at some point this will be prophetic, because I do believe that at somebody, you know, we were just talking about the recent events at Heathrow Airport.
Well, let's bring that up, because it's the timing of the play. I know you're leaving back for London.
I think I'm going to be delayed going in because all the flights are going to be backlogged.
Yeah, they're going to be backlogged all over. And a lot of flights coming out of London. This is August 10th when we're doing this, because there was a legitimate terrorist alert about liquid bombs are what they're worried about. Anything that's liquid. I'm drinking a can of Coke. I couldn't take that on the plane. Even baby formula, if you're not willing to you know, drink a little of it, you're not going to be able to take it on. Because they said that certain liquids, if you mix them together on the flight, they could cause a bomb. So they're literally taking anything that's liquid off the planes. And, boy, that's going to be hard because none of the machines they have can detect liquid.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how that's all going to resolve itself. Yeah. What I do know is that at some point you'll progress from liquid bombs, and at some point someone will make a bomb that is organic that actually fits inside a person. It might not happen for a few years, but eventually that will be the natural progression.
Well, you know, it's scary. I have a pacemaker and defibrillator, right? And I have to do the pat down. But at what you're going to have them cut it out of me before I can go on a plane?
Well, this is it. In fact, Smith says, you know, he has this line where he says, if we have to open up every citizen of this country, open them right up and sift through them with tweezers, if that's what it takes to beat the threat to our civilized society, then we will not flinch from our task. And it's that rather terrifying idea that, you know, what happens when the technology becomes sufficient that it really becomes almost impossible to tell without physically absolutely sort of opening or x-raying or...
Yeah, that's pretty scary stuff.
It's pretty scary. And how do we as a society react to that threat? Because do we eventually want to live in a safe prison or a perilous freedom? And I think we have to make that choice.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's what makes what we're doing so important. Is this is how we ultimately beat the terrorists, where you can write dramas and comedies like this and entertain people. Because those that want us all blown up, that's the last thing, though. Entertainment, you know, you and I are the first ones on the list to get shot. You know that. Because we're involved in the quote, decadence of the entertainment industry. We should be praying 20 times to God or something.
Yeah, I want to go on to write a play about exactly that. We've had this issue in Europe with rights of free speech, because free speech has been... in some instances, quite badly curtailed in the UK.
Has
and
it really?
It depends in certain areas. We've had some legislation recently, and there was a big furore that Rowan Atkinson got involved in, the actor who plays Mr. Bean, and he was.
Oh, is that right?
It was over the what you can or cannot say in public with regard to other people's religions. This all started with a guy called Abu Hamza, who was this sort of. He had a hook as a hand, and he had an eye patch, and he looked like a bad sort of Bond baddie. And he used to stand outside a place called Finsbury Mosque, and he used to essentially preach about how the decadence of the Western civilization, and he would preach this sort of very fundamentalist message. Whether he was actually actively, or at what point he was actively encouraging people to go and commit acts of terrorism was arguable, and that's eventually he seemed to overstep that line, and he was arrested. But legislation had to be brought in to stop him standing.
See, that's terrible, because that's always been the strength of the American and British system, was you have the right to get up there and condemn everybody. And our American Civil Liberties Union actually defended the Nazis who tried to march in Jewish areas of Skokie, Illinois. As repulsive as that is, that's part of the fundamental beliefs.
Absolutely.
So you're saying that's shifting it in England, because that's scary, because we usually follow what you guys start. Boy, that's scary. Yeah.
There were cartoons published. I don't know if you saw this in Denmark. These Danish cartoons.
Yeah, the Danish cartoons. I'm well aware of.
And there was a massive demonstrations in the UK, and it's coming to the point where at what point do we have to curtail what we say? And if you accept taboos from all these communities, if you accept all the taboos that would pertain to the Jewish community, to the Hindu community, to the Muslim community, and you don't say anything that would potentially upset those, you find yourself, certainly as a writer and a creative person, with a very little area in which to maneuver.
Well, you know what you end up with? An American primetime sitcom.
No, I've never.
Our comedies that are on prime time in America, they call them the sitcoms, and they're so bland because they're afraid of offending anybody because of sponsorships, and that is the most boring, ridiculous kind of entertainment. I'd rather watch the commercials are better. And now, have you had any pressure on you from this play?
No, I mean it's
they never tried to censor you.
No, and it's nice. I mean, the play is pretty politically incorrect.
Well, it sure is. And I mean, you guys, you're taking. You're taking shots right at the government.
Absolutely. Well, it's part of the government, and it comes out with, you know, there's terms in the play that, you know, by the standards of political correctness would be considered, you know, improper. But that's exactly it. It has to get under your skin. It has to challenge you. And I think exactly if you curtail yourself and you only say what you think everyone's going to want to hear, it's a disaster.
You know, it used to be where journalists were the last ones to hold up the, you know, democracy. But again, they're getting influenced. Both your media and our media is getting influenced. I think maybe it's the arts now. It's guys like you. It's the playwrights. And it's the brave actors and directors and producers who have the guts to mount these shows. I maybe, not to pat ourselves on the back, but maybe we're the ones with the wake-up call.
Well, I hope so. You know, and I do believe. And I was sitting here watching this production last night, and I did have this moment. You know, drama started with the Greeks, and it started with the idea that you could, through a play, address issues which were absolutely crucial to the way you lived and the society you lived in. It wasn't cocktail party entertainment. The Greeks went along, they had a festival, 5 days, everyone would stop their jobs, and they'd all go, and they'd all watch three tragedies and a comedy for 5 days in a row. And those players would address issues that were absolutely relevant, and then there'd be legislation that would come in on the back of those plays that would affect their society directly. So it was almost like a conference. It was like a giant society.
That's true. We forget that. That's true.
And that's how drama began. It wasn't just entertainment. It had a practical sort of societal purpose. And, you know, it can so easily be forgotten in the case of a good musical, and everyone goes along, they have a good old, you know, we had a wonderful time, you have a cocktail, you have a drink, you go home, you laugh, you forget it, you pick up the kids. And I sat here last night, and I thought, well, you know, there's 25 people here, but these 25 people and these guys who've given up their time and their talent to mount this, at least we are trying to change the way people, or make people address issues, which are of increasing importance.
I've said in my review, it's a valid role for theater to take, and you make it entertaining. So we're not, you know, this isn't just a propaganda piece. This is funny. This is a funny show. So they can come to the Actors Workshop. Let me put a little commercial in for them. Actors Workshop is at 1044 West Bryn Mawr in Chicago. It's a little storefront theater. They do marvelous productions, and the play we're talking about is Proving Mr. Jennings. And it's going to run, it runs Thursday through Saturdays at 8 p.m., Sundays at 3 p.m., and it runs through September 3rd. So you got to be excited to break in with a play here in the United States.
Well, it would be lovely. I mean, a couple of people have talked about how difficult, especially, you know, the politics in this country seems very divided. It's straight down the middle.
Yeah, it is. It's either the blue states or the red states, yeah.
And people have talked about how if you try to address these issues in a sincere play that was set in America, that you would honestly have, you know, large sections of people would just go, well, you know, after the first 10 minutes, we'd go, well, it's not my politics, and they'd be out.
Yeah, they'd walk, literally, they would walk out, yes.
And, in fact, we've just said there's a small theater in San Antonio who's expressed an interest in doing it already.
San Antonio?
Yeah, which would be right in the heart of sort of, you know.
Right in the heart of the blue country,
yeah,
Bush country, yeah.
And it would be great. I mean, I'd be fascinated to see what happens there. But all I think is a little bit like when Miller was writing about McCarthyism. He didn't write a play in which Senator McCarthy walked up and started telling everyone they were communists. He wrote a play about 1690s. The Crucible. And so in the same way, what I think that if Proving Mr. Jennings might have the potential to let Americans engage with this issue, but through a prism that is alien enough to them that it doesn't immediately, you know, make them sort of have a reaction that's actually an unthinking reaction.
Right. No, it gets them thinking, but it gets them laughing. And it's funny about how laughter sort of opens up and relaxes you, so that when you hit them with the zingers and those little subtle lines that come in there, and they're not so subtle. I mean, but in the context of the humor, all of a sudden you're laughing and you're going, oh, wow, that's scary. Then you're laughing again. Oh, that's scary too. Yeah.
Yeah.
But it ultimately gets you thinking about these issues.
Well, I hope so. And we were just talking earlier about there's an episode with some photographs that are used against Jennings.
Oh, yeah. Tell us about that. Yeah. Right. When he apparently when he was sedated, they put him
it's a compromising
position
that he's not aware of, and then these photographs are used against him, and it's this idea of this English gent. So they essentially want him to sign a confession, and they use this as one of a number of tactics to make him eventually sign. And they say that unless he does, they will be shown to his family. And at that point, he's expecting the arrival of his wife, Sylvie, who appears at the end of the scene.
Yeah, that kind of shocked them.
And he really doesn't want her to have to see those. That was based entirely on the episode at Guantanamo where they had the piled up bodies and the pictures of the girl who was sort of giving the thumbs up. And these were used in interrogation techniques to intimidate these men and say, well, unless you give us the information we need, we will show these to your families, which for an Arab man was the most humiliating thing imaginable. And for an English gentleman of Jennings's ilk, a similar thing. And within these funny, and I hope the passage on stage plays funny. You know?
Yes, it does. It does play funny.
But it would be lovely if people walked out and then went, you know what, that is a little bit like that whole Guantanamo, actually. That's not, it's exactly, this comes from the same pod. I've chosen to treat it comedically.
So you took real events and tried to present them comedically, but still have the message and the strength of them.
Yeah, well, I mean, once the central image of the bomb and the heart was there, so that the tone of the play had to be kind of crazily absurd. Mm-hmm. But then I thought that was the most important thing was to make it real. And so I collated hundreds of real-life stories.
Well, the electric shocks, that's well known.
Absolutely. And the torture scene is unfortunately, you know, something that's getting more and more frequent. And we've recently had the flights of them, you know, the U.S. are flying people to prisons all over Europe. And they're using the British as a base, and then they fly people out, the whatever they call them.
Well, that's how they deny that. Well, we're not violating American law.
Yeah, you know, we're doing it elsewhere.
Bulgarian do it, or you know, I mean, there's always somebody in every country who will do it, especially if they don't have to admit that they're doing it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's even, you know, there's a scene with inquiries, and there was a girl who in Britain was about to be sacked from her job at the MOD, or was sacked, in fact, and she
from the what?
The Ministry of Defence.
Okay.
She said that there was sort of dealings that were a little dodgy, and she was then sacked. She appealed against her redundancy on the basis that she was only telling the truth. And there was an inquiry launched, and at the results of the hearing as to decide whether she should be made redundant or not, they said the inquiry has been concluded, and I'm afraid the results are too secret for us to be able to tell you. So it was this wonderful circular spiral.
That's right out of the British comedies that we see on the BBC.
It completely is. Yeah. And
it's true.
And it's just absolutely true. So you're getting all this exactly the same.
Well, here they're supposed to be whistleblower laws, but again, they don't work. They always find another reason. She was late twice or something, right? And that's enough to lose.
Absolutely. But we have a new... She had an Inquiries Act in the UK quite recently that enables a minister to suppress evidence, to withdraw the inquiry.
Yeah, you're scaring me more and more. I know we always had a little bit more freedom, but you guys were always so close that it was so subtle. But now there seems to be a bigger difference.
Well, there really is. We had in the UK, we had the Labour Party conference. Tony Blair was speaking, and then Jack Straw, the Foreign Secretary, started speaking. And there was a guy in the back who was an old man. He was 72. He'd been a party member for years and years. And he sat at the back, and Jack Straw was talking about the Iraq War. And at the back of the auditorium, this gentleman shouted, "Lies! It's all lies!" And in a healthy democracy, you would have thought that's the kind of, you get heckled if you're standing up.
Right.
No, there was two guards came from the back and they took this guy out and they charged him under the Terrorism Act. And he was then detained. And then there were two other old ladies who crossed into an American base. They were protesters. They literally walked 10 feet over a base. They were just in their anorak standing in there. And now there's a new law passed that all American sort of bases are now a sort of sovereign soil, and there's a particular law that applies to them. So these two ladies were arrested under the Terrorism Act again. And this is going, is this the society that I want to live in?
Yeah.
I appreciate there's issues we have to deal with. There
no, I don't. It's not the America I want to live in. It's a long ride down to Australia or New Zealand. And then they follow us, too. So where do you go then? Well, it's important that you brought this play here. And you're saying San Antonio may get mounted?
May get San Antonio. I'd love to see it. You know, it'd be great if as I say, that the Americans can deal with these issues through looking at a British scenario.
I think we can. And Goodman Theatre and Steppenwolf have done nothing quite, I don't think, as biting as this or as updated as this. But they've done some challenging things. You know, we're open to it. And Chicago's a good town for it.
Absolutely. Well, I love being here. I've had a
Is this your first visit here?
I came for George Cedarquist, the director's wedding, who's my great friend. And I was here about a year ago. I love it. I love it. It's sort of open. It's very welcoming. And I love the theatre scene here. These little shop fronts.
Yeah, you've got to come. Make sure you hold on to my email address. You got to come in town when you can spend a week or two, and I can take you around to see some of the theater. You would be blown away by by the caliber of the theater here.
I'm really
What do you have going now? I understand you've got a few projects going.
Yeah, I'm working on a play for the National Theatre in London.
Very good. This is one you got a commission for, right?
Yeah, and this is another it's another political play.
Good. We need them.
And it's amazing how many probably the most politicized era for a long time amongst young people because of the issues that we've just been talking about. Most new writing is not political still. It's mostly kind of family dramas, you know, young
people. I'm so tired of relationship dramas, yeah.
This is it, and they're still being written all the time. Set in an apartment, a girl, two guys, an abortion, you know.
Yeah.
And not many people are addressing it, or if they are addressing the politics, they're taking it so head-on. I mean, David Hare had a play on called Stuff Happens at the National Theatre, which was about the lead-up to the Iraq War. And I have to say, you know, I admire a lot of David Hare's work. That particular play, it had George Bush was in, Tony Blair was in it. I mean, not obviously they were actors playing these parts, but there was no metaphor there. They came on and they did conversations that were transcripted, and it was absolutely just hitting you on the nose with
it. It's pure propaganda. Yeah, that's not entertaining. That would bore me to tears.
And that's what people said. And I think that theatre works. Make a documentary about it. Great.
Right.
But theatre works with metaphor. You know, the greats of modern, the last 100 years
right.
have chosen metaphors with which to tell us stories.
And extremes.
Yeah.
Yeah, extremes one way or another. You do it with the absurdist, with the bomb implanted in the chest.
Yeah.
And so your next play is political.
So that's another political play that's set in 1919, and it revolves around the Conference of Versailles, which ended the First World War. And in fact, on President Wilson, I mean, there's a large
right,
American
yes.
angle there, because Wilson came over with his 14...
Yeah, I'm quite familiar with that era. I'm a real history buff. Yeah.
Well, it's a great...
That's great. That's a good idea.
Well, so much of the actions, in fact, of the last 100 years were set...
Yes.
Were set
Well,
there.
World War II
was almost
set
result.
There, yeah. Right.
But I mean, even more in terms of what's happening in the Middle East, there were decisions made then. In fact,
boundaries, and they invented those countries.
Absolutely. Yeah, and what we forget is that we, the British, and in fact, this is another play that I want to come work on. We, the British, invented Iraq. We created Iraq.
Yes, you did.
Out of three separate Ottoman Empire states, and they were always separate. The Sunnis were separate, the Shias were separate, and the Kurds were separate. And the Ottomans always administered it as three separates.
Oh.
And we came together under Winston Churchill, and he personally oversaw it. And he said, no, for administrative purposes, it would be much easier to stick it together. He was warned that it would never work as one unit, that they would rip each other apart. He said, no, we'll keep it like that.
Well, they did it all through Africa, too. It's Absolutely. One of the reasons we're having all the tribal battles now. The lines of where the political lines and the tribal lines don't work.
And where do you draw a line? And these guys were literally 1919 sitting over a map. I mean, there was four of them in a room with a big map, and they were just dividing up.
Is this a comedy or
it's yeah, I mean, certainly there's one play which is going to involve some, it's actually a story about some Siberians. It's set partly in Russia and partly in Paris, and I think that isn't going to be a comedy. The play about Iraq, again, I think it's so tragically serious that I think the only way you can address it is probably through comedy. And also the nature of it is so absurd. You've got this idea of, you know, English statesmen willy-nilly determining the lives and the fates of millions of people for the next 100 years.
Now it's the Americans doing it over there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And they're drawing the boundaries.
And we don't learn the lessons, do we? Well, you need to keep writing. Sounds like this is what you're after. And you have a film going, too, you were saying.
I do. I have a small production company in London, and we've worked with some short films. And then we're now working on our first feature film, which we hope to get into production next year.
Well, I hope we have a good run for the play here in Chicago. And I think it will. I think this will help, and I think the word of mouth gets around it. And the buzz there when the play was over, and, you know, opening night audience, you had a lot of critics here, and you had people from our Jeff committee here. I think they liked it. I think they were impressed with the writing of the play, and I think it'll do well here.
Well, it'd be lovely to see it have a life here and elsewhere in the States. I hope it speaks in some way, and it was lovely to see audiences reacting and so strongly.
Well, and it's always great to get a young playwright on this, because the way you're, from what I've seen of your work, I think this might be an interview that I want to save, because you know, the Brits are pretty good at producing some great playwrights, and you come from a great tradition.
Well, that's very flattering, very kind. Thank you.
Thank you, next time you're in Chicago, ring me up, and we'll definitely do some theater.
I'd love to.
thank you, folks. Thanks for listening. And go see this play. It is at the Actors Workshop. And you can click on over to the reviews and you'll see that we like this play. And I think you'll enjoy it, too. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Well, thank you very much for listening to this elucidated episode of Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast, brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. But before we let you go, it's time for your Shakespeare Quote of the Week. The following quote deals with confusion, and it comes from The Tragedy of Macbeth, King of Scotland, Act 2, Scene 3. Confusion now hath made his masterpiece. Well, we can't thank you enough for listening to Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Remember, we are here every Monday with a new episode ready to stick in your ears. So until next time, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.